Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. This is week four of Financial Literacy Month. Week four, and there is still so much ahead. We're going to head out into the metaverse. The metaverse, where people are using real money, like actual real money, to buy virtual real estate. Is this what the world has come to? Stephanie Hughes is a reporter for the Financial Post, and she is here to tell us how that works. And we'll talk about financial planning for those who want to live forever, like immortality. It's called cryonics, right? It's when you store your body in the deep freeze. That part's easy, but how are you going to pay for groceries 200 years later when they thaw you out? Lawyer Mark House will be here to take us through the financial considerations before you decide to freeze yourself at sub-zero temperatures. Then we've all seen how the pandemic has impacted thousands and thousands of jobs in Canada. There are some things that you should know to be prepared for a scenario in which you lose your job. Lawyer Hermie Abraham from Advocation is here to share her guide for preparing yourself in case you lose your job. We're also going to talk about aging in place. Yvonne Chemetsky from Home Equity Bank is going to be here to talk about some of the financial things you need to consider as you think about whether you stay or go from your principal residence. Plus Key, it's called Key, a new Toronto startup helping renters get into the real estate market, kind of a hybrid model. And I'll speak with the co-founders, Rob Richards and Daniel Dubois. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. As strong as the economy is right now, there are still a lot of Canadians who are dealing with uncertainty around their employment and sometimes job loss, right? It happens. The impact can get more pronounced as you get older. There is ageism. Some jobs are simply harder to do physically. A roofer at 27 has an easier time than a roofer at 67, for example. And you're also closer to that mythical retirement age. So how can you best prepare yourself for the risk of losing your job? For more on this, we're going to talk to Hermie Abraham. She's an employment lawyer that heads Advocation Professional Corporation, and they provide legal advice to employers and employees in Toronto. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
We are speaking because your company dropped a flyer in my mailbox, and on the one side, it referenced the risk for people age 50 plus getting fired, and on the other side, it said that you could live in denial or be ready to protect yourself. It was kind of inflammatory, so much so that I decided we should book an interview. What were you getting at here?
Well, you know, it wasn't meant to be inflammatory. It was meant to be a bit of a wake-up call, because the unfortunate situation is a lot of the people I see are people who have been blindsided by job loss. I think that people in my demographic, and I'm in that 50 plus demographic as well too, kind of bought into the belief that you can retire with the company that you start your career with, and that really isn't true anymore. So it was really meant to be a wake-up call so people can start helping to prepare themselves in the case that a job loss that they're not looking to bring about happens.
Well, it was a wake-up call. I'll say that for sure. How do you go about protecting yourself?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that people should know is that your employer, in most cases, your employer has 100% control about whether or not they wish to dismiss you. So one of the questions I always get is like, oh, well, you know, I had great performance reviews. I was given a bonus. I received, you know, a raise just a few months ago, and now I'm being dismissed and it doesn't seem fair. Well, unfortunately, it's not, but your employer can dismiss you at any time for any reason. So you can't protect yourself against that, but there's lots that you can do to be able to prepare yourself if that happens. And the first thing, which is not, you know, is sort of a precursor to this, and it's the least sexy thing, is your employment contract. People very rarely review their employment contracts because they don't see their employment contracts as being very important. But I always say employment contracts are the prenuptial agreements in the employment context. And so if you have a contract that limits your severance package, that's going to have a huge impact if you are terminated and you're looking for compensation because you haven't protected yourself. So that's one really big thing I think that some people can do sort of well ahead of time.
What other things would you flag on that employment contract?
Yeah, so with the employment contract, you'll see there'll be termination clauses, right? Again, limiting your entitlements. Sometimes even with very senior people, and you know, just last week I went through consultations with two people who unfortunately were dismissed, but the contracts had limitations that they're only entitled to the Employment Standards Act. And here in Ontario, that can mean 1 week for each year that you worked, or maybe maximum two. So if you've been at your company for 5 years, the most you might get as a severance package is 10 weeks. And for most people who are earning, you know, a good salary and have a job that is going to take a while to find, 10 weeks isn't a lot of time, right? So that's one thing, like the termination clause. Some is also the post-employment restrictions. There are some circumstances where you might be restricted from some of your activities once you finish work, and that will impact your ability to find new work, right? So maybe not non-competition, but definitely non-solicitation clauses.
You said you can be fired for no reason. That's the starting point. Mm-hmm. And there are some examples of when a termination would violate the Human Rights Code. What would be some examples?
Yeah, and I'll say that those ones are pretty few and far between because most employers know better. But an example would be your employer dismissing you simply because you're a specific age, right? So if, let's say, you've hit a specific age and your employer is like, I don't want to have people over 50 working in my workplace, I'm going to dismiss you, that would be against the Human Rights Code. Or if I'm going to dismiss somebody because they are of a certain race group or a particular gender, I'm going to dismiss them. That would be against the Human Rights Code. But as we know, a lot of dismissals do happen when you're over 50. And it's not because of the age necessarily. It's because of the fact that, one, you might be more expensive to the organization. The organization might feel that continuing to employ you would create a greater severance obligation versus dismissing you and starting from scratch and hiring somebody who is maybe younger, but also has, a lower salary band. So those are the circumstances where, you know, it might feel like age discrimination, but it doesn't count as age discrimination under the human rights, because the primary reason for the dismissal was not because of the age, it was because of the effect of the age, the outcome of the fact that somebody's been in an organization either for a long period of time or earning a high amount in terms of salary.
It can be really shocking to have that conversation where you A, find out that you've been terminated, and B, that you have to, you know, adhere to some sort of a deadline on signing back that severance package. You would say that is not a legal deadline. How do you think about, if you're the employee there that's been terminated, how do you think about that deadline?
Yeah, so that deadline is really a way for the employer to conclude matters with you as soon as possible. And I would say that in my experience, and I'd say it's becoming less and less, that's why I think the contract of employment is so important. But in my experience, employers, when they are providing a severance package, they're expecting some kind of back and forth discussions or negotiations about some changes in it. So the deadline is to hurry up those discussions. I would say if somebody does receive a severance package, the best thing that they can do is review it with a lawyer. People worry about the cost of a lawyer. You might be walking away from, you know, more money than what the lawyer will ultimately cost you, right? And so the cost benefit of speaking to someone before you sign that legal document, because in most cases, any type of termination letter or release is a legal document, speak to someone, understand your rights. So at least, even if you do decide to proceed and sign the document, you're signing it fully knowing, you know, what you're giving up, or, you know, where your legal rights are. So the deadline do, meet with someone prior to the deadline, but understand that that deadline is also flexible.
Now, you're a lawyer, so I assume you charge $14 million an hour. That's like about the average amount these days. I'm kidding. What is the average dollar ring for a client that you serve? Because I think it's really helpful to have in mind, like, is this $500? Is this $5,000?
Yeah. So I'll say this, anybody can get legal assistance at any salary range. There are so many options available for people to be able to get legal assistance. So that's the first thing. I think that people believe in their mind that it's going to be more expensive than it is. That's not necessarily true. In terms of a review of a severance package, our firm charges $635. That $635 in many cases will also be reimbursed by the employer who's dismissed the employee. So you might, the employee might be in a situation where they're not even out of pocket at all for the dismissal. So I say that, and that's what we charge. There are people who charge, the range, there's a range from hundreds of dollars to, thousands, right? But I would say that, you will still find, anybody can find a lawyer to review your severance package at a reasonable rate.
Yeah.
If we are hired to negotiate a severance package, we charge a fixed fee. And that fixed fee we set, and I don't want to say it now in case this is aired and another time we change our fee, but I'll tell you that it's in the thousands of dollars. And typically we will not even take on a client unless we know that for every dollar in the fee that they are spending with us, we're going to get them at least $3 to $5 back. Wow. Right. So we always want to make sure that there's going to be some cost benefit. And I'll tell you, in most cases, it's a 1 to 10 times amount because the employer again makes a contribution. So I think that not knowing and the belief about legal fees sort of keep people stuck, and they should do their due diligence, but you can find assistance.
Yeah, it is money well spent to have that consultation in first order. Hermy, thank you for joining us today.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Bruce.
Hermy Abraham is an employment lawyer. She heads Advocation, and our conversation was about what to do and the things to think about if you are suddenly faced with a termination. And I'd say it is worth making that follow-up call.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The pandemic has been a public relations nightmare for the retirement living sector, right? Stories of seniors trapped inside their rooms for months at a time with the risk of infection swirling outside their doors provided lots of support for the case to age in place. And of course, there are pros to that option. There are cons too. And certainly one issue that many seniors need to think through are the financials. Joining us now to talk about some of those variables, some of those questions, is Yvonne Shemetsky. She is the Executive Vice President at Home Equity Bank. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I'm great. The disclosure here, Home Equity Bank is a sponsor of Moolah Law and Credit Canada's Financial Literacy Month efforts. And your key product, the one that most consumers would know, is a reverse mortgage, which is, I think, what gives you insight into this particular demographic and the challenges that they face. I want to start off, Yvonne, by asking you how you would characterize the environment today for seniors on the question of home.
I think that the pandemic has been absolutely a game changer in this space because, we've been in our homes now for over a year and a half, and there's been varying degrees of rules tightening and relaxing. But what it has done for everybody, it has made us realize how much safety and security and homes mean to us. Mm-hmm. Now, think about it in our demographic. So our product is for people 55 and older, but our average client is 72 plus, and my parents are 75 and 78. For them, the safety of the home, knowing that they can have groceries delivered, that they don't have to go out, they don't have to interact with other people and potentially get infected, it has been a game changer because people don't want to move. People don't want to go into a retirement home. People's lives have changed during the pandemic.
And certainly, I know this for my parents, home has a deep, deep, deep emotional connection. So that perhaps goes without saying. But tell us a bit about the financial considerations for seniors, because some have done extraordinarily well, at least in the value of the asset, if they've lived there for a long time, given how much home prices have gone up over the past decade across Canada. But that's not the only piece of the puzzle.
No, it's not. So I usually talk about a couple of R's of retirement. So the two under the financial considerations that I like to talk about, one is review and the other one is research. And the review one is related to, you know, it could be any, it doesn't matter how old you are. You should always be every few years reviewing your financial situation. What are your expenses? How much money do you have coming in? Are there any significant health changes or, you know, family situations that are impacting your finances? Because things do change and we plan, we like to plan, but there's always the unexpected. So people are creatures of habit and we like to avoid difficult conversations. We like to avoid difficult circumstances, but that review component is very, very important because you need to know how much money you have. Can you afford to stay in your home? Can you actually afford to do something else? So then the second piece is the research piece, because you know, you may think that you have too many expenses or your house is too big or, you know, the stairs are too steep, whatever it is. You need to do research because you need to research your options. You need to look into downsizing. You know, how much can you sell your house for? I'm actually helping a good family friend whose parents need to move and they don't know how much their house could be worth. So we're trying to figure out an appraisal for them, figure out how much is it worth. If they sell, where else can they buy? The costs of downsizing, you know, not just financial, but emotional. Are you going to be able to walk to your favorite coffee shop or pharmacy or doctor? Mm-hmm. Where are your friends living? So in the research component, I often tell people, you know, try to imagine yourself living in Collingwood or try to imagine yourself living in a condo downtown. What is your life going to look like? And when they come back after doing a little bit of a reconnaissance, things aren't always what they seem. And a lot of people want to actually stay in their homes and age in place.
Two of the costs that would be really important in that research phase are property taxes, which if your house has increased in value dramatically over time, are not what they were a decade or two ago. And second is maintenance. So if you've lived in your house for a very long time, every decade or so, there are some pretty big ticket items that you might have to pay for. How do you put that into the spreadsheet?
So first of all, you need to be realistic, right? You need to, I have a family friend who is 85 years old and she has a pool and she's been avoiding dealing with the pool because it has expenses. Well, you can't, because now 5-6 years later of not dealing with a pool, the costs are a lot higher than what they would have been if she kept up with regular maintenance every year on the pool. So I would say, you know, be realistic and figure out if it's an appreciating asset or if it's, you know, what's your average cost of upkeep of the house? And then also think about big expenses, you know, roof needs to be fixed or landscaping. A lot of older people need to make sure that the stairs are safe, that the railing is there. I have a client who used to use her side door for 15 years because she didn't have a railing on her front doorstep. So be very realistic with what those costs are. You can go online and you can actually Google pretty much anything and you'll get decent ranges and then you can work them into the spreadsheet. The spreadsheet has to have balance, right? Don't assume best case scenario that your house was not going to need any repairs, but also don't assume that, you know, the sky is going to fall.
Some seniors are solo. Some seniors have a spouse. They have kids. They have grandkids. What role do you think adult kids play here in terms of this analysis, in terms of the research and review?
Oh, that's a loaded question. So
yeah, and differs by family, I'm sure.
It absolutely does. So my parents who live in Poland, for example, and I can say this on the radio here because they won't be listening, they don't really want to talk to us about money and their retirement and what their plans are. They're very private. They're Eastern European. It's not in the culture. So it has been a lot of work for my sister and I to open the door and to have conversations. And every family is different. Every situation is different. But I would say, you know, if you are visiting your parents for Thanksgiving, for Christmas, or you're just dropping by and you're seeing repairs are not getting done, if you're seeing that the bills are piling up, that is probably a signal to you to figure out a way to have a conversation, or if they had a fall, or if something happened in the house. And then the other thing I tell people, you know, you can't have these conversations around the big holidays, and you can't have them kind of, you can't walk through the front door and demand to have a conversation about it. You need to find the right time. You need to find the right space. You need to get them in the right mood. And so sometimes the preparation to have that conversation can take a few months just to find the right time and to get involved.
Because there's the dollars and cents of all this. And then there's the, for example, the cognitive ability to manage the dollars and cents. And we don't get exponentially better at that from the years, you know, 75 to 105. Predictably, most of us will see some decline.
Yes, absolutely. But that's why if you visit your parents, or if you're in contact with them, even on Zoom, you can see, you know, what does the background look like? Are they, you know, are they wearing the same clothes? Are they looking put together? Those can be very, very good cues. I can tell when I speak with my parents by the tone of their voice, if something's going on, because I talk to them so much, I kind of know the regular conversation tone, and then when something's off, so then you can kind of probe a little bit further. But you know, conversations with family about money are really, really difficult. Every family is different. You have to see how far you can push. I'm very open with my kids. I have two daughters. One is 14, one is 22. I've been very open since they were young about finances and my wishes and, you know, all the documents and all the accounts. But I think it may be a little bit of a generational thing. So we have to proceed with caution.
100%. Yvonne, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Yvonne Shemetsky is Executive Vice President of Home Equity Bank. And we were talking about some of the financial considerations for seniors. It is a tough game. I, like Yvonne, am very grateful that I have open communication with my parents in particular. My kid's a little young, but with my parents in particular, so we could navigate these things out in the open. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we're Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. And we have so much going on for Financial Literacy Month. Go to creditcanada.com/FLM, and you're going to learn about our free virtual events, our webinars, access all sorts of tools. If you are feeling overwhelmed by the debt you are carrying, go to creditcanada.com and book an appointment, or find our phone number and call us. One of our accredited counselors is going to talk you down and tell you about the various options that you have. You do have options, I promise you. Moolala is also sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank. Coming up next on Moolala, a new Toronto startup helping renters get into the real estate market. Co-founders Rob Richards and Danielle Dubois tell us about Key. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, do not fear. You can head over to our website. It's at moolala.ca. You can search for the name of the guest. You can search for the topic. You can watch or listen to full episodes of the show, whatever is easiest for you.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Housing markets in big cities, well, in pretty much anywhere you live in this country, but big cities in particular, are very, very, very difficult to get into as average prices continued to go sky high. But not everybody wants to rent either. So we've got this, you know, rent or own dichotomy here. And there could be a third hybrid option. I mean, there's a number of options out there, but this one really caught my eye. It is a startup in Toronto called Key. And basically, oversimplified to the nth degree, it lets prospective homeowners basically co-own a property. Co-founders Rob Richards and Daniel Dubois join us now to talk about how it works. Hello, gentlemen.
Pleasure to be with you, Bruce.
Yeah, thanks, Rob, for having us.
You're welcome. Rob, what inspired you to get moving on this? You saw a real shift towards investors. Was that the fundamental insight?
Yeah, after the 2008 mortgage meltdown, qualifications tightened, investors came into housing en masse, prices rising faster than wages, and our young people and frontline workers, people who need to live in the city where they work, housing became further and further out of reach. I mean, the idea of owning a home, now it's what, 30 years in Toronto to save for a down payment? And the two big blockers are one, that big down payment, and two, being able to qualify for a mortgage, which few could do. And so this was keeping our people locked off the property ladder for most of their adult lives. And I thought, there just has to be a better way. And I looked at my background of using all things digital to reinvent old industries and came up with a new model of home ownership consumption.
Daniel, how does it work? How's Key work?
Yeah, so it starts with just 2.5%. You can now own a home years sooner with just, if on a $600,000 home, you can purchase it with just $15,000 and you're a co-owner. So as Rob mentioned, we eliminate the two biggest blockers holding people back from being able to own a home. The first is a large down payment, and the second is qualifying for and having to service a mortgage. So with Key, you can be an owner from day one without qualifying for a mortgage ever. And the more you own, the less monthly payment, essentially the less rent that you would pay.
You talk about qualifying and the challenge that can be for people. What do you notice for clients in terms of their financial readiness? So down payment aside, do they need a particular credit score? Do they need proof of income? Do you need them to be able to demonstrate that they could be a long-term owner?
Yeah, well, the people who now own with Key generally have a decent job, anywhere in the sort of 60, 70K and up kind of range. And we do background checks, we do credit checks and income analysis, and just know that their level of household debt to their income is something that they can afford to pay the monthly fee. And with Key, because you're making that 2.5% initial investment, that's the equivalent to having 6 or 7 months of rent on file. So we can work with people if their income is interrupted, if they're having a bit of a tough go. We have several months to work with them. before having to take action.
It's early days here. What do you predict the duration will be for your clients who choose this option? Because one of the advantages to renting is you can, you know, give 2 months notice and move to Calgary or whatever, move to Europe. How long do you think people will stay with this? Is this a part of the ladder they would then exit and go buy in a traditional way, or they take that 2.5 to 20 to 60 to 100 over time?
So this is a foundational innovation that we're creating. It's where a world where you can have most of the benefits of home ownership, but with the freedoms and flexibility of renting. So a bit of my inspiration that led me to meeting Rob, who's been thinking about this for over 5 years, is I sold my last company. I moved to Toronto. I hired a realtor to help me find a place to buy. And then I felt like it wasn't a point in my life that I was ready for a long-term mortgage. If I bought a place and sold it a year or two later, I'm not getting any further ahead. Plus, there's all the time costs and hassles associated with traditional home ownership. So if Key existed, I could have bought a home within the Key ecosystem. Every month, I could choose to purchase more. The more I own, the less rent I would pay, and I would have the freedoms and flexibility as if I was in a traditional rental.
Who are the investors here?
Well, the owners of the real estate could be a family that own one or two condos. They could be a family office that might own 30 or 40 homes, could be a corporation that owns a number of homes. A whole variety of investor owners can easily attach their real estate to the Key platform.
And the renter is not, as I understand it, not on title. So what rights do they have and what are the risk factors here?
The resident and the asset owner, the owner on title, enter into a private co-ownership contract. And that contract spells out all the rights and obligations of both parties. And it actually gives consumers a lot of protection. We think more protection than the Residential Tenancy Act does. And so you have the sole right to occupy. You share in repairs and maintenance on a pro rata basis. So if you own 10% of the home, you're paying 10% of buying that new fridge if you need one. You have the security of tenancy that you don't get in being a renter, that you only get with ownership. So for the first 3-year term, the owner can't sell the property and you can't buy the property. We call that a soak-in period. And after that 3 years, the occupant, the owner resident, has the option to follow through to purchase 100% of the home. Now, you asked us earlier, how many people will do that? How long will they live with us? And the short answer is we don't yet know. We think that people want to save up to build their equity position so that in 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, when they're in a much better position financially to take on a conventional mortgage, they can do so.
How do the fees work? And I don't even know if you would use that as a word, but I assume you two are not working for free here. There's some sort of middle person cost. How does that play into the whole algorithm?
Yeah, so Key has created a win-win between the asset owner and the owner resident. Our fee structure is quite simple. We charge only 1% of the contributed equity from the owner resident. So if they were to co-purchase a home valued at $600,000, 2.5% would be $15,000. Key would only charge $150 on that transaction. And then we charge the asset owner on a per unit per month basis for sourcing, vetting, and providing a higher quality resident to live in one of the homes and co-own it with them.
Rob, how do the owners think about rate of return? So they've got lots of places they could park that investable capital. It could be in private equity, it could be in a hedge fund, it could be in the stock market, it could be in the bond market, it could be all sorts of places. How would you frame the sort of rate of return expectations that they could have?
Well, I think real estate has always been a good non-correlated investment. And, depending on the market, varies anywhere from maybe 7 or 8% per annum to something higher, 10 or 15%. So for the asset owner, they've already made the decision to own real estate and have that in their portfolio. And with Key, they're going to achieve upwards of maybe 10% or more better net operating income. And they get that by having reduced vacancy, as Daniel said, a higher quality resident who shares in repairs and maintenance, who thinks like an owner, who turns over less, the cost of turnover is less. You add all of that up and eliminate any delinquencies on monthly payments. and you get a higher net operating income for the asset owner.
What are the risks to your model in the event of a real estate market correction? And not like anybody's predicting that. There are many macro themes that would support this ongoing growth, limited supply being one of them. But for people who've lived on this planet for long enough, we have seen massive corrections in the price of real estate through history. Rob, how does the model hold up? How do you plan for that risk?
Well, that's one of the real beauties of Key is that the residents, it's just their equity investment that may be at risk, and they're never at risk of getting underwater relative to the mortgage debt because they don't have a mortgage. So if you have a $15,000 investment in your $600K condo and the market goes down 10%, you've lost $1,500 only. You're going to walk away with $13,500. Right. And as opposed to walking away with nothing if all of a sudden your equity position is underwater relative right. to that mortgage.
And one last question here in terms of risk for the people carrying that mortgage. What happens if rates go closer to historical norms in the, 5 to 7% range?
Well, I think, we've seen time and time again through different interest rate environments, through four recessions that we've been through in the last 40 years in the condo industry, that you have these downturns. I think the early 90s was the worst when interest rates were much higher. But real estate is always up and to the right. So it's just a question of weathering that downturn in overall return performance based on paying a higher interest rate. And maybe the asset goes down in value a little bit, but it's going to come back. And so do you have the operating income to service that? And with Key, you have a very stable tenant who is an aspirational, owner. They're a co-owner and they're there because they need to live in the city. They're there because that's where they work and that's where they want to be. They don't want to commute 3 hours a day or drive to qualify. And so we have a very stable base of co-owners who are going to ensure that you have a much smoother net operating income.
Really interesting stuff. Daniel, Rob, thank you for joining me today.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Co-founders Rob Richards and Danielle Dubois have been working on a new, call it third option, a hybrid option to have renters be owners at a smaller scale. It is called Key. Stay with us. Coming up later, we're going to talk to Stephanie Hughes, also about real estate, but this is a bit off-piste here. This is the metaverse, and this is virtual real estate. But first, financial planning for those who plan on living forever. Yes, you heard that right. Lawyer Mark House is going to be here with financial tips for believers in cryonics. We have a newsletter for Moolala. If you'd like to sign up, you go to moolala.ca to do that. We've got all the stuff that we cover on CBC Radio and CityLine and BNN Bloomberg and all that kind of stuff.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Now, our show talks a lot about estate planning. We talk about how to prepare for your financial future. We do this kind of thing all the time. But what if your future spans longer than the traditional mortality tables, like after you're dead, or at least dead as we know it? Some people believe that they will be able to preserve their body at sub-zero temperatures, hoping that technology will advance and they can potentially, at some point in the future, maybe hundreds of years down the road, they will be revived. This is called cryonics, and you've heard of it, right? But if it is something that you are genuinely interested in, there's some very interesting financial questions that you need to ponder lest you wake up with no cash for your groceries in a couple hundred years. Mark House is a lawyer. His firm is Becker & House. He focuses on estate and trust litigation, and he works a lot with cryonicists regarding estate planning. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Bruce. How you doing?
What sort of looks do you get when you talk about this with people? Because I think there's some really interesting questions here. And at the very same time, a part of me is like, this is a bit nutso.
So when I'm talking to non-cryonicists, by the way, I'm a professor at Arizona State University, so I'm an adjunct, and I teach trust and estates. And I routinely hear that the favorite day of class for my trust students is the day that we actually get to go out to Alcor and sit through Max Moore's presentation about, you know, what cryonics is.
Yeah.
And then take a tour of the facility. And then we have an in-depth discussion about all the pretty intricate legal issues on how to create what we call revival trusts, which are trusts that are designed to have assets that are held for hundreds of years. But yeah, when I mentioned this at dinner parties, my wife loves to tell me that I'm just like the thrill of any party, because this is by far the most interesting topic that exists.
Yeah, I would say it may be almost as interesting as psychedelics and investing in psychedelics. Like, I put them on par right now. When we think about the financial implications here, highlight two or three that are the most relevant. Because I think the first one that comes to mind is, like, you thaw, it's 22, 200 years from now, and you need to go buy some food. How do you go about doing that?
Well, I mean, we're really looking at it from the standpoint of an evolution of what currency is, an evolution of what the market would look like. And one of the reasons why we use the trust structure that we do is because it can evolve along the way. The idea of burying money in your backyard or something along those lines, you're running the risk that, you know, fiat currency or gold or whatever would exist doesn't have any value in 200 years. But if we're using a trust structure that is designed to evolve along with the financial market, then the theory is that you'll always have something of value when you come back to offer to go buy groceries, for example.
Who are those assets connected to? Because typically in estate planning, when you die, they get passed on to someone else.
Sure. So what we do is there's a couple of different ways to do it. The most basic way is to do what's called a simple accumulation trust. So the person dies, they're cryopreserved, and then the assets are put into a trust for their revived selves. And as long as that is quantifiable within the rule against perpetuities period, you are treated as if you have an ascertained beneficiary. And you can have just an accumulation trust for the rule against perpetuities period. So that's the generic design for most of these. We also have what amounts to, and I know this is an estate planning show, so your listeners are probably familiar with dynasty trusts. We also have just created dynasty trusts with this weird beneficiary at the end, so that if the grantor gets revived in 200 years, they just become a beneficiary of the trust.
Right. We don't know about dynasty trust, but that could be because we're too young for that television show and the shoulder pads that were involved, or because we're Canadian.
Well, kind of dynasty, Bruce.
Yeah. Right. Okay. All right. We're like the Ming Vaz kind of thing. What would you say globally about these kinds of financial arrangements that can exist in perpetuity? Is the U.S. ahead of the game? Are there other countries that are further ahead?
No, the U.S. is way out in front on this one. In fact, a lot of what I'm doing when I try and do it internationally, doesn't translate well around the world yet. For instance, I'm working with some clients in the United Kingdom, and because of the restrictions that the U.K. places on trust, they're very punitive. So you have... every decade you've got significant tax liability that comes along with having assets and trust in the UK. And so we do run into some significant problems when we're dealing with anybody outside of the US.
So there's the structure of the trust, and then there is what those assets are invested in. And if it was today, you'd say, okay, they could go in a money market. They could go in a broad-based exchange traded fund. What would you say they're going, what vehicles would they be in, given that they may not be used for hundreds of years?
I mean, the general investment principles are not terribly different than any other long-term investment horizon. The folks that I have at Raymond James and at Trust Bank, which are the two corporate trustees that I use on these, have, you know, investment plans that are not terribly different than those you would see for any other investment that's going to last for 30 or 40 or 50 years. You're trying to generate long-term growth out of capital appreciation. modest amounts of bond holdings, very little held in cash, that kind of thing, because you don't have the immediate liquidity needs. And so, it's just a very long-term investment portfolio that is designed with a lot of flexibility.
I can imagine it's very difficult to determine what amount would make sense, given that the magic of compound interest, even at a 3 or 4% annual rate of return, is going to equal 14 gazillion bazillion dollars in 200 years.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, though. There were a couple of trusts that were done back, and I believe one of them was actually done by Ben Franklin, where they had this kind of 100-year time horizon, and everybody assumed that the miracle of compound interest was going to generate massive, massive amounts of money, and it turned out it didn't work that way. But the theory is that if you have if you can outperform inflation by 4 or 5 percentage points, yes, you can, over a couple hundred years, you'll end up with massive, massive amounts of money. But you have to outperform inflation. You have to take into account the tax code. So you have to, pay attention to what the income taxes are going to be. As Congress looks at making trusts less and less income tax advantaged in terms of their taxation on income, this becomes very real concerns in terms of what the investment portfolio has to look like. But yeah, and you ask kind of an interesting question of how much do you put away? Nobody has any clue. A lot of it is according to your ability. I mean, I have some clients who are putting multiple millions of dollars away. I have some that are putting, 100,000, 200,000 and just hoping for the best.
Mark House is a lawyer. His firm is Becker & House. He focuses on estate and trust litigation, and he works a lot with cryonicists. Coming up next, Financial Post reporter Stephanie Hughes will take us into the metaverse, where we'll talk about buying virtual real estate with real money. If you have comments or questions or story ideas about the show, send us an email, ask@moolala.ca, ask@moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Okay, we're going to have a jargon festival in this next interview. NFTs, the metaverse, Bitcoin you probably heard about, but probably not metaverse, or at least maybe in a limited way. Everything is going digital these days. Even Facebook is taking on this Meta moniker in its name. So we're going to talk about the metaverse, but in particular, we're going to talk about real estate within this world, virtual real estate paid for with real money. It seems like a terrible idea, but Stephanie Hughes is going to explain it all to us. She is a reporter for the Financial Post. Hello there.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
What is the metaverse? I mean, I think I know, but I think I'd embarrass myself if I defined it. So let's leave that to you.
For sure. So what you need to know about the metaverse is that it's essentially a virtual reality space where people can take their virtual avatars, log into this virtual world and just interact with each other. So it's an alternate space that you can chat, work, play games, check out these events like NFT art galleries or these concerts like Ariana Grande's Fortnite concert and shop around to buy virtual things for your virtual people.
As you describe it, it sounds like Second Life. But Second Life is like 10 years ago. Is it an advanced version of that?
So yeah, it does. It definitely has its roots in that precursor with Second Life. And to be honest, the metaverse has been quite established in video games like Minecraft, Animal Crossing, Fortnite. Like I mentioned, is an example of the metaverse rather. It's not the newest concept, but it's coming to the forefront because of, I suppose, some of the more opportunities that you can do with it. So NFTs are a huge part of the metaverse with this whole metanomics. And it sounds very spacey, this whole thing. And there's a whole reason for that. It was actually the fun fact here is that the term metaverse was actually coined by Neal Stephenson in his 1992 novel Snow Crash to describe this virtual world that people would just kind of plug into using virtual avatars. So like you mentioned, not exactly the newest thing. Whereas Second Life was more, I guess, content driven. This is kind of a more creative, collaborative, like on Decentraland, you can kind of create your own properties and the like.
So virtual real estate, but paid for with real money. How does it work and how does it make any sense? Like so, any sense at all?
For sure. It does have a lot of people scratching their heads. Why would people pay actual money for properties they can't physically exist in? And so how it works is that, say you have this platform like Decentraland, there's a bunch of others like Upland, Crypto Voxels, Sandbox, Somnium Space. So basically it works as an NFT on the blockchain network. So think of the NFT as a land deed. You buy this virtual parcel of land. It could run between about like between 15,000 Canadian and it goes up from there. So since MANA, the native currency on the Decentraland platform, has just shot up and skyrocketed. So you get your native cryptocurrency for Decentraland, MANA, and then you buy these parcels, and then you have this certificate of authenticity that it's your property or your kind of block on that metaverse that's supported by an NFT. So on that block, you can build properties, you can rent it out. I know some companies are doing that. And why people would do this is because, like any kind of asset, it's a store of value that these retail investors anticipate will gain in wealth for them. So
there was this thing online, it probably still exists, where you could become like a lord or a lady from a country estate in Scotland, and they would sell you like a square meter of their estate in the Highlands. It sounds so gimmicky.
You know what? You know, I heard about that same thing and I thought it kind of neat, but kind of gimmicky. This could be, you know, it depends what you have a use for. I know in some cases, a lot of people like to rent out a space in the metaverse and have a metaverse art gallery or metaverse concert or some sort of showcase. So whether they actually own a piece of the metaverse or they just go to like a commercial metaverse company that actually leases out this block, it does have some practical uses. Or if you're just getting your own little square property there, you can maybe throw a metaverse house party. I mean, you don't have to clean up after, you don't have to worry about guests, how they get home.
I sound like my great, great grandfather when I have this skepticism about why I would pay for virtual real estate in the metaverse where I could just create a web page for free.
Oh, for sure. You absolutely could create a web page for free. But what the metaverse properties could do, and I'm not trying to sell anybody on why everybody should buy a block on the metaverse, but it's been sold to me as basically a store of value that will appreciate in value. And then something that there's like an experience that's intrinsic to it. So you can invite people over, anybody can kind of come in. It's this verified block somewhere. And it's just, especially when you look at places like Upland, where you can actually gain quite a bit of profit, and it's just this buy, sell, and trade game. And in Decentraland, some people become like almost like these metaverse millionaires through just owning property and waiting.
Metaverse millionaires. What, you cover this for the Post, as I mentioned off the top, what role is Canada playing here? I mean, are we in the game on virtual real estate and metaverse and non-fungible tokens, those NFTs, or are we laggards? I have no idea.
Well, actually, it's interesting you should bring that up, because I was kind of looking around and seeing the Canadian perspective, and you've got a lot of headlines and a lot of stories where people actually did sell NFT properties. So Toronto artist Krista Kim sold a virtual home NFT, and it looks beautiful, by the way, for about $650,000 or 288 Ether. And the way she said it, it's going to outlive any condo in the space. So you've got artists like her, you've got, I believe it's a Canadian company, Metaverse Property, who's actually buying up these lands and leasing them out. So trying to become like a commercial REIT, but just virtual REIT. Mm-hmm. It's a very abstract concept, but yeah, you do see quite a few Canadian players, and there's a huge interest in, I believe I was reading a study the other day where there was more Google searches for NFTs and the like in Canada. So I believe then other countries like the US and Australia, but I believe there's quite an uptick in interest in Canada.
Interest, geez. So we've talked about the buyers of, the sellers of. There's also an interesting role for governments. And you know, I mean, there's been lots of talk about central banks and cryptocurrency, but I saw this headline where Barbados is looking to become the first sovereign embassy in the metaverse. Have you heard of this? Did someone make this up?
No, it's a real thing. So what you need to know about Barbados is that they've always been kind of a crypto-friendly country. So they actually did, the Barbadian Minister of Foreign Affairs and Foreign Trade, or that ministry rather, sign an agreement in November with Decentraland to establish a digital embassy there. And they're kind of finalizing agreements with Somnium Space and Superworld. So yeah, they seem to think this has merit to it, and they're willing to plant their flag down there.
Wow. Well, Barbados is gorgeous. I wouldn't want virtual real estate there. I'd want actual live real estate adjacent to the Crane Hotel. That would be perfect. Stephanie, thank you for joining us and for putting up with my very like old and crusty questions from the 1960s or so.
Thanks for having me. This was really fun.
Stephanie Hughes, reporter for the Financial Post, to talk about the metaverse and educate us on the merits and, well, the pros and cons of buying virtual real estate with real money. That is our show for today. Thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, our newsletter is the best way to do that. You can subscribe at moolala.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast version of this SiriusXM show. And while you are on your podcast platform, leave us a review. We would be helpful. It doesn't even have to be a good review. It could be a terrible review and it would still be helpful. Follow me on social media at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great day.